This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
The Lindsay Clancy murder trial is 3 weeks into testimony at Plymouth Superior Court. The prosecution has called more than 60 witnesses. The problem is that some of the most damaging testimony the jury has heard actually came from the Commonwealth, from the actual DA themselves, from the prosecution. Don't ask me why, but it seems to be how things are playing out. Someone who has now been in the courtroom for this last week to give us a perspective on everything we've been discussing here in a way that only Bob can. And not just because he's Bob, but because he's been in the actual room. And when you're in the room, it's a little different than just being there with cameras. Bob Mata of Defense Diaries with myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. All right, let's dive into it because Bob's got to get on a boat because he's going to Cheers for lunch.
They always know your name
as well.
They're always glad you came.
They do. They do. So the prosecution called 5 mental health professionals this week. Lindsay's psychiatrist, 2 psychiatric nurse practitioners, a counselor. Every one of them described a woman begging for help, switching medications, losing sleep for days. So all the people like, I'm waiting to hear the evidence from the medical professionals. Well, there you fucking go. It's been there all week. I can't help if you're not absorbing it. All Commonwealth witnesses. So who is actually building the insanity defense here? Because it feels like the Commonwealth is doing pretty good at building the defense. They're saying she didn't have. Bob, what was it like in there?
Well, I mean, if I want to work backwards, yesterday when they decided to sandwich the autopsies in the beginning of the case and then stick an autopsy or two towards the end of their case.
Yeah.
And you get the intended result from the Commonwealth, which is Lindsay Clancy just evaporating into a puddle, inconsolable, can't control her side. I'm sitting 10 feet away from her.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in the same row across the aisle where the media sits that her parents are sitting, and they're sobbing. And if I'm to work my way back from that, it's like you said, there's just nothing like sitting in the courtroom, you know, and it's interesting to be an observer as opposed to being on the other side of the bar and arguing the case. But man, as far as the Commonwealth's case, I can't agree with you more, T. I mean, you're hearing the story from the Commonwealth's witnesses. They're asking flat out. Reddington asked Tufts flat out. She wasn't doctor shopping. No, she wasn't. She wasn't pill seeking. No, she was. This is coming from their witnesses, mm-hmm. based on their evaluations, yeah. as shitty as they were, you know, but what becomes clear, what became clear to me is how she ended up with these 4 different healthcare providers.
Yeah.
You know, it made sense when we learned that she was going to Tufts and then she's like, you know what? I don't know that she's really doing much for me. I'm going to go over to this other facility at the behest of her mother-in-law,
yeah.
Patrick's mother, who's a labor and delivery nurse, who obviously had a relationship with NP, nurse practitioner Julie Paul, yeah. who was fabulous.
Could have saved.
I mean, I realize she's named in the complaint, but my estimation of her as a witness is that had she been able to remain on,
yeah,
we would not be here right now.
So evident. That was so clearly evident because you saw, you know, especially coming in after Tufts, you saw the depth of field difference between apples and oranges. I mean, it wasn't even a fruit group. It was like going from apples to tomatoes or something. It was so vastly different between those. The vesting that she had as a nurse practitioner, a psychiatric nurse practitioner, and coming from labor and delivery, with taking a text on the weekend, taking a phone call on the weekend, and granted, you know, I know a lot of people think you need to have this work-life balance, but there's professions and there's jobs. And she took this as a profession. She was all in. When you have someone in crisis like that, all her years of reps, you know, and then they had a consulting group there as well. You know, Tufts didn't consult on this with anyone. It was just startling. So, Bob, we're seeing the effect. I'm watching. I was looking for you all week in the audience there. What I know what we're feeling at home, which is traumatic. We're seeing her fall apart. We're seeing the redirects that people are doing onto Patrick. And I think just because of his affect was different, and also because people are believing it couldn't possibly be her. Look at her. It couldn't possibly. So they got to pin it somewhere else. That's the effect coming through the camera. What's the jury doing? What do you feel in that courtroom from the jury? How are they seeing this, you think?
So in the debacle day, which was not yesterday, but the day prior, the jury was obviously feeling it. There was one juror in particular, and I've seen, like, my wife is like, you have to be telling the people what the jury's doing. And I'm like, well, honey, you know as well as I do that I can't read minds, and neither can you, and I've never met a lawyer that can. What are they thinking? I have no idea. If, you know, I give body language the weight that it deserves, which is very little.
Part of the whole.
Right. You know, right. It's part of the collective. Are there things that people do that obviously are indicative of a feeling? Obviously. So I'm not dismissing that, but, you know, thinking that you've cracked a case and you've figured somebody out based on the body language, I just don't subscribe to that.
Yeah.
I'm not besmirching anybody that believes that stuff, but, you know, good on you. But there was a woman in the second row, because what I was looking at, a lot of jurors were stealing glances at Lindsay during the breakdowns. All right. So almost the entire first row, there's two younger, I'd say the two youngest jurors, female, in that first row. You know, they would steal a 3 to 5 second glance at her as she's breaking down. There was a woman, I would say, over 50, back row, who was just staring, watching Lindsay the entire time. And you know, and dabbing her eyes. Now, what she's dabbing her eyes for could be a multitude of things, obviously. You know, it could be that she's feeling empathy for Lindsay, as I do. I put a tweet out contemporaneous to that moment going on where I said I desperately wish I could give Lindsay Clancy a hug.
Yeah, so that saw the response to that too.
Yeah, you saw the response to that. I'm here for it. I'm here for it. Because if it gets the mental health conversation going, yes. I'm here.
Bob, you have empathy for people. How dare you?
And there, I think the win has already occurred. I was talking to Todd and Tony before you got on, Bob. You know, this has been such an attention draw for so many reasons. And there is no justice for these children. She's right. Going to be behind bars, either locked to a bed or in general pop for the rest of her life. She just wants to die. And we all agree with the fact that she killed her kids. It looks as if she premeditated it. The only argument is, was she psychotic during the premeditation or not? And that's what these experts, especially on defense, are going to say and claim. And when you look at those, when you look at her behavior in the courtroom, when you look at the testimony of anyone, the only thing that could justify someone who had a life arc of hers for that is a psychotic break. I've never even seen one this profound. And so we're not even arguing on any of the facts. It just comes down to, will the jury believe she's psychotic or not? Was she in that state? Which is completely, as we're going to find when Reddington hits it on Monday, completely within exactly what the definition of all this is.
I feel like people don't understand what psychotic means. I mean, I saw it right there in the comments. Not one has said she was psychotic. Not one. Okay, we say that five more times, and maybe you'll feel better about yourself. But here's how this works. In the treatment, in the times that they were visiting her prior to this, she was not in a psychotic state. She just wasn't there yet. Okay, there's the answer to your question. That's why they didn't say she was in a psychotic state at that moment in time. Like,
she felt it, you, this is something, it goes in and out. It can happen for a burst and be done. They're not going to know 3 to 4 weeks in advance that she's in a psychotic state. There's a difference, and this is what Siobhan always talks about. There's a difference between someone who is a psychopath and psychosis. Two very different things. It's about as stupid as saying, well, they didn't treat that burn victim for burn injuries when they went in for the checkup 5 weeks earlier. Well, they didn't have, they weren't in the house that burned down yet. But why didn't they treat them for burns? Because they weren't yet a burn victim. That's how that works.
And it was very, it was established that she was in, there was elements of mania coming in here. And as Siobhan described, mania is a stepping stone to the psychosis. I mean, but that, again, we're going to find out on Monday. Hey, we'll see what the experts say on Monday when defense has their turn, or if he hit it on Tuesday. But
18 people is a lot of people to get onto the same page of this. Yep. I mean, Bob, I know, you know, body language is only one thing. You've been in a lot of courtrooms, though. You've seen a lot of people try to sell a line of bullshit to a jury. Yep. And you know it's a line of bullshit. And some really try hard. Some are just defiant and assholes like Corey Richens. Obviously, this is its own monster over here, of what we're dealing with. When you compare it to that, when you compare it to rooms where you've seen people really try to get one over on somebody or present in a way that they really want them to believe something. I don't think Lindsay Clancy gives a shit what anybody thinks of her by her reactions. Is that coming across? I mean, where do you feel the jury, or how do you feel the jury is receiving her outbursts, for lack of a better term? And I mean, I'd be outbursting too, I mean, in a situation like this. How do you think it's being received when they're shutting down court, when they're taking breaks because of it? Are they feeling empathetic? Are they feeling emotionally moved by what is going on here? And I guess it can be moved in either direction, but what's been the observation?
Yeah, you'd have to be emotionally dead not to have feelings, and like you said, what those feelings are depend on the mindset of that person.
Yeah,
but it's impossible not to feel it in that courtroom. I mean, it's like I always say that trials are fascinating to people because we're watching the human condition in its worst possible light, and we find it fascinating.
Yeah,
you know, and we're sitting here watching this in real time with an understanding from my perspective that this woman was failed by everybody that she came in contact with in the healthcare system. And she realizes, she knows what she did. Like, I mean, are people under the misconception that Lindsay Clancy did not become aware of the fact that she killed her own children, the people that she loved more than anybody in the world? And that's right. Like, I need that to resonate with people. I need people to understand that. She loved those three children more than any other human being on the planet. And she did this to them. Mm-hmm. And if you don't think that she knows that, she knew it immediately. Like, she's been knowing it for years. Yeah. This is her... Her hell, the hellscape that is her mind, is worse than any prison cell that exists on the planet.
Yeah.
Where she's living at, second to second, every day of her life is an absolute hell that I would not wish upon my worst enemy. And so what you're seeing with this jury is it is impactful. How it's going to impact that particular jury is an individual by individual thing, because as you're seeing online, when I posted the desperately wish I could give her a hug, you know, all the torch and pitchfork, all the I don't give a shit, eye for an eye people, I don't care if she was psychotic. I mean, there is a portion of the population that in this circumstance, when a mother kills her own children, is unwilling to give them a pass no matter what the reason is. You did the act. And throwing you in jail, and we're throwing away the key.
And it's not a pass. Well, it's not a pass. She's not getting out of jail. That's the thing that's getting me. It's just not a pass.
What gets me is it's so much greater than this case. Nobody's trying to give Lindsey Clancy a pass. She can go away forever. I'm cool with that. But I think she's cool with that, too. It's about understanding this and recognizing this so it can be caught. Can it be seen earlier? And this is one of those cases where I don't know that you really could get much. I mean, there's certainly other ways that you could have helped Lindsey Clancy, and we probably wouldn't be in this space. But psychosis, when in a condition like this, the way it did, it kicked in. Whatever triggered it, and what happened is what happened, which can very scarily happen to almost anybody if they're in the right sort of state. And I think that scares a lot of people, and they're afraid to really go down that road and understand that. But the reason for this conversation, the reason that this is a big case and people are talking about it, is to prevent the next one. Is to put the medical establishment on notice, to shine a light going, look at all these ways that you failed this woman, or that we could at least do things differently. If we're not going to go down the road that they failed her, that the way your system is working as directed, which is really kind of, there's not a lot in this that went really off the rails. It's just the rails are so loose and wide that it allows for this sort of a horrific way of helping someone. And we need to fix it, because this is just one case that we're hearing about. There are far more where other horrible things happen and it doesn't get a national stage for attention. This is not necessarily a huge one-off here. This is a broken system that people are living in and suffering in every single damn day. And when you see that list of the medications, I saw one of the tweets this morning about it. And this is, look at that. I mean, look at, these are the meds that she was prescribed over the course of 30 days. I mean, or three months. Any of those numbers would be insane. Well, she didn't take all of them. She took a lot of them. She took damn near almost all of them on and off. And when you're mixing these things on and off at these different levels that you get, I'm surprised she didn't do worse shit. I'm surprised she wasn't in a grocery store blowing everyone away when you're on that level of meds.
It was in her system. You know, the medical examiner tested blood. Those things, they were in the system. She was taking them.
The Commonwealth sitting there trying to put out there that she took enough of everything to know how it was making her feel.
Yeah.
Period. End of conversation. I don't give a fuck what people say about that. We like every single prescription medication, individuals react differently to it. Period. Yeah. End of conversation. There is not a baseline where everybody acts the same on this particular. Our minds are all built differently. Our biology is different, yeah. but synaptically speaking, how it's going to affect one individual. My father, day one after they prescribed him Seroquel to help him sleep, came up the next morning and he's like, I felt like I was crazy. This is after one night, first night taking Seroquel. I couldn't tell if I was in reality. I couldn't tell if I was sleeping or if I was awake. He's like, that shit should be banned. It needs to be off the market. And you know, when you, the thing about all these scripts and throwing the polypharmaceutical cocktail at her is that none of these fucking doctors and nurses were going back to see any of the medical records from anybody that she was seeing prior to. Can you ask your patient for information and rely on that? Yes, to a certain extent. To a certain extent. You can't take it as gospel. If you have somebody that is suffering from mental illness, it is imperative, and this is proof of it.
Yeah.
That you need to do the work. You need to go back, get the medical records. You get a waiver. You get a HIPAA form that's signed by Lindsay, and she says, of course you can go get all my records. And typically in this day and age, you do it electronically. This isn't like everything that exists with this case is so confounding. And what it really is it's easy to point the finger at Tufts and say, oh, she was, you know, 30 days after coming board certified. She was a neophyte. Where were the people behind her?
Yeah.
The system is broken because when you have a young psychiatrist coming in and she unwittingly gets a very complicated case that's exacerbated by the fact that her patient is an R&D, labor and delivery nurse who she might be thinking, oh, and who's very A-type. Like Lindsay keeps very detailed journals. She's a fucking nurse. She's doing research. She's asking questions. She's saying, this makes me feel this way. This makes me feel this way. And so it's like when a lawyer, when a lawyer is representing another lawyer, it's a nightmare for a client because, you know, that lawyer is always going to have their own thoughts. Whereas with the normal client, your client is just accepting your advice at face value. When you have a lawyer that you're representing, it's a terrible relationship because that lawyer basically wants to try their own case, but they understand
exactly,
and it's the same shit that she was going through with Lindsay. Yeah. At some point he's thinking Lindsay's just a pain in the ass. She's just throwing scripts at her. She's giving her some pamphlets about some groups that she can go and, you know, some therapy shit, group session. That's not therapy.
Yeah.
And when you have a situation where there's not some kind of red flag or triggering event for a facility to say, okay, if you put her on seven different things, you need to step up and ask somebody with a little more more experience, or we need to roundtable it and collectively try to figure out what's going on with this woman. Yeah. Because when they misdiagnose her and miss the fact that she had that manic episode, and I'm talking about a manic episode, a woman running a 5K 4 days after they gave birth is fucking manic.
Yeah.
And you missed it. So when they give her the Zoloft right from the get, and it has this toxic effect on her immediately, it was because they didn't look at her records. They didn't understand that in her first bout, obviously much less with Dawson, but still she had some postpartum depression issues, and she was manic. They missed that. So combing in to Callan being born and when it starts to hit, and then they just start throwing the shit at her, it's like that message she says, I can't remember if it was Gelada or Tufts, that she sent the message, and I think it was Gelada. It rocked me to my core, and it broke this case down in one sentence. And it was, I just feel like I'm not being heard.
Yes.
Yeah.
For me, I was ready to walk out of the courtroom and be like, you know what? I don't even think that I need to put a case on.
Bob, Siobhan hit this, our psychotherapist, on Wednesday when she's been following this and taking voracious notes on this. And she's been appalled at on the mental health side of this as well. And her, you talked about those red flags. She said there was a glaring red flag that she saw that no one was paying attention to, and they kept dismissing it, the lack of sleep. She said that lack of sleep that she kept reporting was throwing kerosene on all these things that are going on. That was what was actually one of the escalators for this, and they weren't addressing that well enough. And especially, like you said, when you have a nurse practitioner who's basically charging herself with her journals and everything she's doing, I think they gave. I think Tufts started out by giving her too much deference because Tufts wasn't being backed up. I mean, you threw her. What an institution just threw her to the wolves. Hey, go make us money. We're going to put your name on the board and claim you're an expert.
And the reality is, this is the system working as it is currently laid out in its current confines. What the rules are, this is how it's allowed to operate. That's why we're talking about it, because 100%. It's broken. It goes so far beyond Lindsay Clancy. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Here we go. We're going to talk about Lindsay Clancy again. I know, surprise, surprise. The prosecution rested in the Lindsay Clancy trial at Plymouth Superior Court after 14 days of testimony. More than 70 witnesses, both sides agree. And that's important to understand here, this case. It's not up for debate. Nobody is debating that she killed Cora Dawson and Callan. She's admitted it
time and time again. You don't get that quite often in murder cases where the person on trial says, yeah, I did it. It was me right here. And then 80% of the audience goes, no, it wasn't. Nah, nah, can't be. But that is somehow what's happening here. The fight is whether she was criminally responsible when she did it. That's what we're talking about. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. And we will get to the conspiracy bullshit too. Robin Dreeke is with us. As always, a retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. There's a lot to get into. Again, the prosecution's first witness. Let's just kind of do a little review here of how we got to where we're at now that the prosecution is wrapped up. Take a little look-see back on the case that they presented and how well they did or didn't. Patrick Clancy was the first witness we saw 14 days ago. He described Lindsay having one of her best days, hours before the killing. Snowman with the kids, photos that she texted him. Then he described months of intrusive thoughts, 13 medications, and a wife he called confusing to live with. Why put their most sympathetic witness first, I guess, is the question. Why did Patrick go on first, and what do you think it did for this case, other than cause a lot of conspiracy theories to begin? Yeah. But more so, what do you think it did for Lindsay Clancy, or not do for Lindsay Clancy, now that that first half of the trial is over?
So let's look at intent. That's what we do with every human being in any situation, is try to understand the intent of the person taking an action and see what their end state is that they're seeking and see what actions they took to support it, because that's exactly what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Because the prosecution is going to act in what they think is their best interest in order to get a conviction on Lindsay. And their claim was that she was not in a psychotic break, that this was premeditated, pre-thought out, planned out, because she wanted to get out of being a mom. She's overwhelmed with being a mom, and she wanted to kill her kids and fake her own death. That is, or fake her own S attempt. So by putting Patrick on first, I can assume, based on they think that's a good action, is that he will, because he had the closest proximity to her, he knew her best, and so he could more accurately claim than anyone else what her state of mind was for months, weeks, days, years, and a timeline of baselining her leading up to the death of her children, his children. And so by doing him first, putting him on first, it establishes that baseline of everything was fine until this. And so this is when she started breaking and cracking. And from the prosecution's narrative, it's going to be because she's overwhelmed with being a mother, not because of mental health or a psychotic break. It was all pre-planned. And then you get into the conspiracy theories. I won't even go there until you want to.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's what it is. It's about establishing that baseline for the jury of she was completely normal, acting normal. And if we want to later on get into comparison with Andrea Yates, which everyone's doing, it's fitting exactly the same. Anyway.
So I think it's important for people to remember there is the courtroom. There is the evidence that's being presented within that courtroom. That jury is told not to read social media, not to be watching us, not to be watching TV about any of the coverage of the case. So they, in theory, should not be absorbing the TikTok verse out there of this conspiracy theory of Patrick Clancy, because that's not part of either case, the prosecution or the defense. That's solely in the minds of TikTok users. Let me ask you this. Patrick, they saw him just as everyone else on the planet did. Do you think in any way, shape, or form, I'm not trying to go too far down the conspiracy road here, but it's more so just recognizing that it exists. Do you think any of those 18 jurors walked away from Patrick Clancy's testimony in court and said, I think he did it? The 18 jurors... did any of those walk away with that theory that is running so rampantly on the internet right now?
No, there's no way. Yeah. And so his demeanor, as we've said before, I've said, as presented before the jury, was kind of a flat effect or affect. And from processing all that he processed and when describing everything that went on, he had – elements of control and trying to compartmentalize from the pain he went through. And it, I think that was evident. I think the main thing that was very telling that it's not him to the jury is a 911 call. Yeah. His reaction during a 911 call, which we didn't hear it.
No.
The jury heard it, but we saw the result of it, and we heard some elements of what happened and the things that he said during it was completely congruent with exactly as it was described by everyone, and then everything gets supported also by the first responders as well. So, but there's no way in living hell, in my estimation, from being in that courtroom, living sequestered basically from the world of information, would I come to a conclusion that it was him. It would start to me, it was a good way to pragmatically and objectively, with someone close to Lindsay, start the case, because it was non-sensational. He wasn't overly emotional. It really, I thought, set the groundwork for what the prosecution was attempting to do to establish a baseline that nothing was abnormal in her life.
And I want to get into the 911 call a little bit more when we talk about Patrick, because, I mean, as soon as you have a piece of evidence in this case that seems to really just be non-contestable, it's like, here's what it is. Mm-hmm. And granted, we didn't get to hear it, and I think that's a flaw on the part of the system. We've heard so many 911 calls in horrendous cases. Why we didn't get to hear this one, I don't know. I think it's stupid.
This one statement, I think, helps.
Well, I think if we've been able to hear it, it would help with the conspiracy theories. Maybe that's my opinion, my guess. Not help them along, but more like quash them down, because right now what you have with the conspiracy theories on Patrick and that 911 call, people keep going back to, he said the effing kids.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That somehow that is a statement of his hatred towards his children. And then that is somehow indicative of him being behind all of it, because he said she killed the effing kids. I would probably say the same thing, quite honestly, because that's how I talk. And just for a moment, I don't mean to go too far down the Patrick route here, but I'm going to on this one, since we're already on this angle of conversation. I have been in a life situation where I was with my partner who had postpartum. It's hellish. It was probably some of the worst times of my life, and I'm not the one who had it. I have so much empathy. I can't imagine being the person that's going through it, because your brain's not working. It's functioning in horrible ways, and it's totally fucking with you. And you're believing some of the ways that your mind is fucking with you. Again, it's horrific, and it can totally screw with you. It wasn't psychosis, but it was not good. It was a rough time there. And I never had a partner that threatened the children or anything. But believe me, as the partner, seeing some of the weird things, if you will, or cognitive distortions that person was coming up with because of what was going on in their brain, it didn't feel all that remotely far off that we could get there, just by ways of talking. So, you know, did those sort of things run through my mind of like, oh my God, what if that were to happen? Yeah, I mean, it scared the shit out of me. It never did happen. But I can tell you, if I'm looking at it through Patrick's shoes and trying to understand where he was at, if I had come home and saw that, if that had happened in my world, I probably would have said the same fucking thing. I would have been like, she killed the effing kids. Why be? Not because you hate your kids, but because, you know, there's been a buildup to this for the last however many years in Patrick's case with the postpartum that he had been the partner of the person for years, and knows how scary it could get and how dark it could get. And it's not that crazy of a thing to step back and be angry and be, oh my God, she effing did it. How that it leads and leans into conspiracy of he had something to do with it, I think totally misses the point and misses any sort of understanding or empathy that one may have for what Patrick was going through in that moment in time.
So here's what you do in every situation. We were talking about this before we started, Tony. So as a behavior guy, or actually any investigator, and our audience, you know, as critical thinkers, here's what we do. The first thing you do when you're presented information or you have a theory, let's start with, I have a theory. The first thing the scientific method and critical thinking does, and the way you should be thinking is, it's now time for me to disprove my theory. Let's see if I can disprove my theory. And then if someone else has another competing theory slash the conspiracy theory, I will do an attempt to prove their conspiracy theory. Because that's how we maintain intellectual honesty. And so let's do it with the 911 call. My first impression was not, oh my God, he said they're fucking kids. So he must have done it. Because when you do that, what you're doing is you're cherry picking a word, giving yourself the confirmation bias that you're looking for to support your conclusion you have. You're not trying to disprove your theory. You're trying to cherry pick what you want to prove your theory because you don't like him because you don't want to place it on Lindsay. You think the healthcare system's fine, so you're going to place it on Patrick. So now I have a theory. I'm going to keep picking, cherry picking thing to prove the theory. So now here's how you reverse it. And so here's my theory. Let's see what I can do to disprove it. Here's a simple thing you do. Listen to other 911 calls. Boom. What every other 911 call that is made by someone, look, go through our past cases that we've had on this show. I challenge you to do it. Every single one where we've had a 911 call where the person that called in a 911 call either became the suspect, was a suspect, convicted of or whatnot, what's the first thing we hear? Them describing their actions when they arrived on scene. In other words, let's do a thought experiment. If he had been indeed the person had done this, what typically would I expect to hear if he had actually done this and tried to act it and try to stage it? He would call 911 and say, hey, I'm Patrick and I just got back from running an errand and picking up dinner for my family. I walked in the front door. Actually, first I saw Lindsay, my wife, on the front yard. I don't know whether she's alive or not. I then decided to walk in. And so he would give a timeline of what he did, his actions for cover. Every single case we've ever covered was exactly that. What was his first reaction? Holy fuck. And that was the reaction to what he saw. And I guarantee you, here's what's also coming out. And I think his F-bomb he dropped was more about him missing it. That was a guilt coming out that it's his. Yeah. So he's not just angry and upset, shocked, traumatized, but also you're hearing his guilt that he went out and said, oh, F-bomb, I should not have done that. So you're hearing all the emotions coming out at once of the action he's observing, not his participation in it. So that is the huge difference. So disproved right there.
Now, I agree. what people can wrap their minds around and conjecture and go, that's fact. It's really kind of baffling in this case.
Context. When you operate cherry picking a word without context or without analysis and easiest thing in the world, just compare and contrast. That's it. There's so much data on all these things. I have pages and pages, my own experience of 22 years in the FBI of behavioral analysis, as well as a treasure trove of data that's out there for you to research on your own. Don't listen to TikTok, who's going for the 5-second clickbait highlight reel that's going to get them the algorithm to get more clicks. Go do your own research with an open mind, with the intent to disprove your own theory and try to prove the conspiracy theory. Take an honest shot at it without the confirmation bias. Don't cherry pick what you're looking for. Go for the opposite opinion. Every time I do research, I'm saying, what are other experts saying? What's the DSM saying? What's the research say? Deep analysis. These are the things I'm doing so I can get a bigger picture of all these things. That's why I did the deep dive on Andrea Yates today. Oh my God, all these people on that. Do some research. You're not even close.
The prosecution, since we're talking about the prosecution's case, it's now rested. One of the biggest witnesses that they called, Dr. Jennifer Tufts. She prescribed 12 of the 30 medications Lindsay received in 4 months. Throw that sentence out there, and I'm just amazed that people are going to try and argue it of like, well, that's not anything to do with this. On cross, Reddington got her to admit she'd never met Lindsay in person, never accessed records from other providers, and didn't know Lindsay had called the S hotline twice. This is a prosecution witness that came up and said all that. If we're talking the legal end of things, this seems to be a witness that you kind of got to bring up in a certain way, in a certain place. But I just feel like, I don't know, they didn't, if I'm on the side of the prosecution, which I'm not, but if I were to put myself in their shoes, I don't think the line of questioning and the things I was able to get to be revealed out of that witness would have necessarily helped my case. I guess I'm wondering, do you think the prosecution here, the prosecutor here, the big boat lady, is fully invested in this case as a prosecutor. We've talked about that with Eric a little bit, of because sometimes that happens. Right. Or is this just as confusing and monotonous and difficult to prosecute, as a prosecutor, as it looks, and you're really kind of being asked to take on a Herculean task of trying to prove that something is not what it is, even right. though the medical facts are pointing towards it, and even medicine and science are working against you. The only thing working for the prosecution is conspiracy. They're in terms of facts and science, it's all leaning in Lindsay's corner. How do you think the prosecutor has weighed that? Do you think that they take any of that into account, or she's taking any of that account in this case?
I think, to your first point, I totally think both of them are completely 100% emotionally vested in her being guilty. Mm-hmm. And here's how you know. When you see Lindsay falling apart, completely collapsing herself, you see the testimony from the people, you see absolutely everything, you see all the emotion in that courtroom coming from everyone but the two prosecutors. And so ask yourself, I made that comment on X the other day about, I'd love to see their psychopathy level scale for those two.
Yeah. But,
so let's put my little jest aside there. What makes someone not have an emotional response to something like that? If they think it's an act. And so I believe they're both completely on board, because they think she staged her arrest attempt, and they think Lindsay staged her S attempt, and that it was a flubbed S attempt. So if you think that someone is acting, then you're not affected by their performance in the courtroom. You're not affected by anything, because you just have this abhorrent distaste and negative, huge negative emotions towards that person. So anything revolving around them, you can completely block out. It doesn't bother them whatsoever. And so I think that's the first baseline on that. And I think what they're doing, they're working with what they got, and what they have is shit. The people involved in trying to prove their theory, in other words, they didn't argue, they're not arguing against their theory, they're not trying to disprove their theory first. They came up with their hypothesis and theory that she's a mother that wanted to get rid of her kids because she's overwhelmed and she wanted to quit. And so they're going to work with what they got. And the first person after Patrick, who is what they got Jennifer Tufts. I'm sorry, is that her first name? But it's Tufts. Dr. Tufts. And who do you have to work with on this one? You have someone that was licensed for 1 month, that had like all the things you pointed out, and the things that Kevin Reddington so majestically, hammered her on, was the fact that she was ill suited to do the job she was doing. But what the prosecution is trying to show, their intent was to say that Lindsay had no problem. She's not reporting anything. It's all on her. There's no issue here. Because look, the psychiatrist says there's no issue. Lindsay's trying to shop for drugs because she's trying to do drugs. I mean, their attempts to try to prove their emotional reaction to things, that she's guilty. So I think and feel she's guilty. I'm going to use what I have. That's why it's landing more on the defense side, because what she has to work with proves the point that this was a shit show leading up to what happened.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I very much fail to see how anyone is getting from, or getting even to, she hated her kids and hated her life and wanted to start out fresh. And this was the method and the lever to get there. Where's the evidence of that at all? Like, there's nothing, not in her journals, not in her writings, not in anything she said to anyone. The only evidence that exists in Lindsay Clancy's history has been, I want to feel better. I want to be a mom again. I want to feel something for my children and my family and myself. She was feeling utter numbness, which is scary. And people fall into that. And bless your heart if you've never been there and you're judging other people who have.
And Tony, I want to add one thing on this that shows this parallel that people are ignoring, because I think it's a good time to insert it. And I apologize if it's not. So the whole diagnoses thing that the prosecution's trying to put its hat on, that she didn't suffer a psychotic break. She never sought help, that she wanted to get out of this. So let's compare that everyone's saying is, well, Andrea Yates was a clear example of it.
Yeah.
Andrea Yates was not diagnosed with a psychosis until the birth of her third child.
Huh.
15 months prior to her actually killing her four children, because then after she was actually diagnosed, it took her three children to be diagnosed. She had postpartum depression, and then after the third, and after her S attempt as well, on the second, are we seeing parallels here that someone says, oh, Andrea Yates is so much different. She was clinically presenting and Lindsay wasn't. No, same exact time period after the same number of children, basically doing the exact same thing. So it took the medical professionals, even back then, to come up with the same conclusion, took them the same amount of time, and almost exactly. And the same people were standing by her that are standing by Lindsay. And even after that case, they said a lot of work has been done to understand women's health and postpartum psychosis. Really? Then how come we're exactly, for those people who say it's different, how come we're exactly matching it again today?
Oh, a lot of work has been done. It's just not a lot of people have accepted it, I think, is the answer to that question. We haven't advanced all that much from witch trial days at the end of the day. As human beings, as visceral human beings, our gut reaction is still burn the witch. It's not ask questions and figure out what actually is happening here. And this is a prime example of it. And it makes you go, 1693 wasn't all that long ago. The prosecution, let's go to our another place in this and give us your thoughts in the comments section about how the prosecution has done so far. Substack, YouTube, drop your thoughts right there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.